You know, it's funny how sometimes a kid's question can just cut right through everything. I was reading about Joel Greenblatt, the investor. He was trying to explain valuing a business, actually, his son Jason's little gum-selling venture.
Kids have a way of doing that.
Totally. And it wasn't even Jason, it was Greenblatt's other son, Ben. He apparently just asked, "Look, if something's really worth $1,000, why on earth would anyone sell it for 500?"
That's brilliant. This is the fundamental question, isn't it?
Exactly. That simple question, that whole idea of finding things selling for way less than they're worth, well, that feels like the perfect starting point for this deep dive.
It really is. Because Ben's question, as simple as it sounds, is basically the puzzle that, all investors, even the pros, are constantly trying to solve.
Right, finding that gap between price and actual value.
That's the heart of it. Making money and investing often comes down to identifying those mismatches.
Okay, so that leads us straight into our source today, the little book that still beats the market by Joel Greenblatt.
Good one. A classic in its way.
Yeah, and don't let the little book part fool you. It's not some super dense finance text. Greenblatt actually wrote it originally to teach his own kids. I think they were in sixth and eighth grade at the time.
Wow, really? Sixth and eighth grade.
Yep. He wanted to teach them how to make smart money choices, specifically in the stock market. So our mission today really is to unpack the main ideas from this book.
And especially that magic formula he talks about, right?
Exactly. We want to look at what he calls his magic formula, which is actually a pretty straightforward way he suggests you can find good, solid companies that are, well, selling cheap, bargain prices.
The fact he wrote it for his kids, that says a lot. It suggests the core idea should be pretty understandable.
It does. He wanted to give them a real tool, something practical for their future. It makes the whole approach feel less intimidating, more down to earth.
Yeah, definitely. And Greenblatt himself, I mean, he's not just some academic. He's got serious credentials.
Oh, absolutely. He founded Gotham Capital, which, by all accounts, had some pretty stellar returns for years. And he teaches investing too, right? At Columbia, I think, an Ivy League school.
That's right. So he's practiced what he preaches, and he teaches it at a high level. Plus, didn't Andrew Tobias write the foreword?
He did. Andrew Tobias, author of The Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need. And Tobias is pretty enthusiastic about Greenblatt and his whole approach in that foreword.
Which adds some serious weight. Tobias is well respected.
It does. And Tobias makes an interesting point, too, kind of hinting at the challenge. He praises the simplicity, but notes that, well, maybe not everyone has the patience for it.
Okay. Bit of foreshadowing there for later in our chat, perhaps.
Could be. So, who's this book really for, or who should be listening to us talk about it?
Well, if you wrote it for sixth graders.
Right. That suggests it's pretty accessible. If you're new to investing, or maybe just curious, you should be able to follow along just fine.
And the promise is pretty big, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something about greatly enriching your future.
Yeah, it's a bold claim. He basically says that by understanding and using these ideas, you can do really well in the stock market. He even suggests some things people learn about investing might be, well, maybe not wrong, but perhaps not the most effective way.
So it offers a different perspective, maybe a more fundamental one.
That's the idea. Whether you're starting out or already investing, he's trying to cut through the noise and offer something clear, something potentially very effective, as an alternative to complex strategies or just handing your money over,
Okay,
et cetera.
so where does he start in the book after the gum story?
Well, he goes back to that fundamental problem Ben highlighted. How do you figure out what a business is really worth? It's tough.
Yeah, valuation is tricky, part art, part science.
And then, even if you have an idea of the value, why does the market sometimes offer it so cheap? He explains the stock market is just, a place where ownership pieces of companies get bought and sold.
Standard stuff, but crucial context.
Right. And to show how crazy prices can get, he uses this classroom example. He'd take big, well-known companies like GE, IBM, Abercrombie and Fitch, whatever, and show students the difference between the highest price and the lowest price their stock hit in just 1 year. And the range was often huge.
Yeah, that's a powerful illustration. Because his point is that the actual business didn't change that dramatically in a year, right?
Exactly. A company making widgets didn't suddenly become twice as good or twice as bad just because its stock price doubled or halved. The underlying business fundamentals are usually much steadier.
So the price swings often seem disconnected from reality.
Precisely. And this brings him to introduce Benjamin Graham's fantastic analogy of Mr. Market.
Ah, yes, Mr. Market. A classic.
You basically imagine the stock market as this kind of manic depressive business partner. Every day, he shows up and names a price. He'll either buy your share of the business or sell you his share at that price.
And the prices can be all over the place, depending on his mood.
Totally random sometimes. But the key thing, Graham says, and Greenblatt emphasizes this, is that you don't have to do anything.
Right. You can just say, no thanks today.
Exactly. You only engage with Mr. Market when he's offering a price that's ridiculously good, either super cheap if you want to buy, or really high if you're thinking of selling.
And on all the other days when the price is just kind of, meh.
You just ignore him. Do nothing. It's a perfectly valid option.
It sounds simple. But doing nothing is surprisingly hard for a lot of people in investing, isn't it? All the noise, the headlines.
Oh, definitely. There's pressure to always be doing something. But Graham's point through Mr. Market is that patience and selectivity are your allies.
Wise words.
And being selective like that leads right into the next crucial idea, the margin of safety.
Okay, explain that.
Think of it like this. You estimate what you think a company is truly worth, let's say $15 a share. A margin of safety means you only buy it if the price is significantly below that, say, $10 a share.
So you're building in a buffer.
Exactly. That $5 difference is your cushion. It protects you if your initial estimate was a bit optimistic or if, you know, something unexpected happens to the company, it gives you wiggle room.
That makes a lot of sense. It acknowledges that valuation isn't precise. It's a core tenet of value investing, really.
It is. So Greenblatt lays this groundwork. Valuing is hard. The market is often irrational. Now what?
Now he gets to the solution. Presumably.
Right. He boils successful investing down to two key ingredients. Super simple on the surface. One, buy good companies. Two, buy them at bargain prices.
Good companies, bargain prices. Okay, sounds good, but how do you measure that?
Ah, that's where he gets specific.
Yeah.
He introduces two financial metrics you can actually look up and use. Earnings yield and return on capital.
Okay, these are the tools for the job. The heart of the magic formula.
Pretty much. Let's break down earnings yield first. The simplest way to think about it is how much profit a business earns compared to the price you pay for one share.
Okay. Profit relative to price.
He uses the gum shop example again. Say Jason's gum shops earn $1.20 per share in profit, and the stock is trading at $12 per share.
Right.
Your earnings yield is $1.20 divided by $12, which is 10%. For every dollar you invest at that price, the company is earning 10 cents.
So higher is better, generally.
Yeah.
More earnings for your investment dollar.
Exactly. More bang for your buck. It's basically the inverse of the PE ratio, the price to earnings ratio people often talk about.
Got it. Instead of price earnings, it's earnings price.
Yeah.
Shows your yield.
Yep. Okay, second ingredient. Return on capital.
How well the company uses its money.
Essentially, yes. Back to Jason's gum stores. Imagine it costs $400,000 to build and stock a store. And let's say that store makes $200,000 in profit each year.
Wow, that's pretty good for a gum store.
Yeah, maybe a bit optimistic, but the math is easy. $200,000 profit on a $400,000 investment is a 50% return on capital.
Okay, high return.
Then he contrasts it with, say, Jimbo's Just Broccoli store. Costs the same $400,000, but maybe only makes $40,000 a year profit. That's only a 10% return on capital.
Much lower.
Yeah.
So you prefer the business with a higher return on capital.
Definitely. It signals a really efficient business, one that's great at turning invested money into profits. It's a sign of a high-quality operation.
And it suggests they might be able to reinvest future profits at similarly high rates, which drives growth.
Precisely. That's a key point. Okay, so we have these two metrics. Earnings yield, how cheap is it relative to earnings? And return on capital, how good is the underlying business?
Got them. High yield, high return.
And now, the magic formula. Drum roll, please.
Uh-huh. Let's hear it.
It's actually surprisingly simple. The formula is just buy companies that rank highly on both metrics, high earnings yield, A&D, high return on capital.
That's it. Rank companies on both. Buy the top ones.
That's the basic idea. The logic is you're buying good businesses, high return on capital, but only when they're on sale, high earnings yield.
The sweet spot. Quality meets value.
Exactly. It's elegant, really. You're not just buying any cheap stock. You're buying cheap, good stocks.
So does it work? What kind of results did he find?
Well, the book presents some pretty eye-popping historical data. He did a backtest over 17 years.
Yep.
A portfolio of about 30 stocks picked using this formula from the largest 3,500 companies, rebalanced annually. Mm-hmm. It apparently averaged about 30.8% per year.
30% per year.
Yeah.
For 17 years. That's huge.
It is. He calculated that like $11,000 invested at that rate would have grown to over $1 million in that time.
Wow. Okay. That certainly gets your attention. Did it work on bigger companies too?
Yeah, he tested it on larger caps as well, top 2,500, top 1,000. The returns were a bit lower, but still really impressive, like 23.7% for the top 2,500, I think.
Still beating the market average by a wide margin and doing it across thousands of stock picks over 17 years. That makes it less likely it was just luck, doesn't it?
That's his argument. The large number of picks over a long period suggests there's something systematic going on, a potential edge.
Okay, so if it's this magic formula that produces 30% returns, why isn't everyone doing it? There must be a catch.
Ah, yes, the catch. Greenblatt is very upfront about this. The formula does not work all the time.
It underperforms sometimes.
Definitely. In his 17-year test, it lagged the market average in, I think, 5 out of every 12 months on average, and it underperformed the market for a full year about once every 4 years.
Okay, so it's not smooth sailing.
Not at all. He even mentions periods where it underperformed for 2 or even 3 years in a row.
Ouch. That would test your patience.
Hugely. He tells these anecdotes. One about a best-selling investment author who created his own successful formula but bailed on it after just a few years of underperformance, missed out on huge gains later.
Yeah, I can imagine that happening. It's tough psychologically to stick with something that isn't working right now.
Exactly. And another story about a really smart money manager whose clients all fled during a down period for his strategy just before it took off again.
So the underperformance weeds people out.
That's Greenblatt's core argument for why the formula can keep working long term. If it worked perfectly every single year, everyone would do it.
And if everyone did it,
The prices of those magic formula stocks would get bid up instantly, and the bargains would disappear. The formula would stop working.
so the periods of underperformance are actually necessary. They keep the playing field from getting too crowded.
That's the idea. It's the pain of underperforming sometimes that deters most investors and allows the potential long-term advantage to persist for those who have the discipline, the patience, and crucially, the belief in the underlying logic.
Belief is key. You have to trust the process, even when it feels wrong short term.
Absolutely. So let's dig into that logic a bit more, especially the high return on capital part. Why is that so important?
Well, as we touched on, companies earning high returns on their existing capital often have opportunities to reinvest their profits back into the business at similarly high rates.
Right, which fuels future growth, like a snowball effect.
Exactly. But, you know, capitalism is competitive. If a company is making outsized profits, rivals will usually try to jump in and grab a piece of the action, right?
Yeah, competition tends to drive down super high returns over time.
So for a company to consistently achieve high returns on capital, it probably needs something special. Some kind of advantage.
Like what?
Greenblatt mentions things like a unique product, maybe a powerful brand name people trust, a dominant market position. Warren Buffett calls it an economic moat.
Ah, the moat, something that protects the business from competitors.
Exactly. It allows them to sustain those high returns for longer than you'd normally expect. That's what makes them good businesses in the formula's eyes.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what about risk? How does Greenblatt think about risk with this formula?
He takes a pretty practical view, maybe different from pure academics. For him, risk is basically two things: the chance of losing your money permanently over the long term,
Okay, that's intuitive.
and the risk of your strategy just consistently underperforming other reasonable options, again, over the long term.
So how does the magic formula stack up against that definition of risk based on his data?
Well, looking at 3-year periods is interesting. For the largest 1,000 stocks in his 17-year study, the formula apparently beat the market average 95% of the time over any given 3-year stretch.
95% over 3 years. That's pretty consistent.
And crucially, he says it never actually lost money over any 3-year period in that group during the study.
Never lost money over 3 years. Wow.
Yeah. And for the broader group, the top 3,500 stocks, the results were apparently even better, beating the market in every single 3-year period tested.
That really highlights the importance of time horizon, doesn't it? You need to be thinking 3, 5 years out or longer.
Absolutely. Short-term fluctuations are noise. A strategy like this needs time to work. You can't judge it based on a few months or even a year.
Okay, so if you buy these good companies cheap, how do the prices eventually go up? What makes the market recognize the value?
Greenblatt mentions a few natural forces. One is just smart investors, like those following his principles, perhaps, identifying the bargains and buying, which pushes prices up.
Okay, bargain hunters.
Another is companies buying back their own shares when they think the stock is undervalued. That reduces the number of shares out there, increasing the ownership percentage for remaining shareholders.
Right, share buybacks.
And finally, there's the possibility of takeovers. Undervalued companies can become attractive targets for larger companies or private equity firms looking for a deal.
So, different mechanisms that tend to pull prices towards fair value over time.
Exactly. The market isn't always efficient in the short term, but these forces tend to nudge things in the right direction eventually.
So, what if someone listening likes these ideas, high return on capital, high earnings yield, but doesn't want to just blindly follow a formula? Can they use these principles for picking their own stocks?
Greenblatt suggests they can. The principles themselves, looking for quality businesses at attractive prices, are a great starting point for any investment research.
But it's not as simple as just running the screen, right?
Definitely not. He cautions that picking individual stocks requires much deeper analysis. You really need to understand the specific business you're buying.
What else does that involve?
He touches on trying to figure out normalized earnings, basically, what the company might earn in a typical year, smoothing out any unusual highs or lows from the most recent results.
Okay. Estimating a more stable earnings power.
Right. And he also discusses concentration versus diversification. If you really understand a few businesses well and are confident in their value, maybe holding just 5 to 8 stocks in different industries could make sense.
A concentrated portfolio.
Yeah. But if you're just following the formula screen without that deep dive into each company, then broader diversification, like the 30 stocks in his back desk, is much safer.
Makes sense. Don't concentrate unless you've really done your homework on each specific company.
Exactly. The formula provides a good starting point, a useful screen, but it's not necessarily a substitute for deep fundamental analysis if you're building your own concentrated portfolio.
Got it. Now, Greenblatt also has some, let's say, blunt things to say about Wall Street in general.
Yes. The there ain't no tooth fairy line.
Yeah, that one.
What's he getting at there? Basically, that success in investing takes real effort and understanding. You can't just wish for good returns or blindly trust others without question.
No easy money, essentially.
Right. He talks about potential conflicts of interest with brokers whose incentives might not always align perfectly with yours.
Mm-hmm.
And he points out the widely known but still sobering fact that most actively managed mutual funds fail to beat simple market index funds after you account for their fees.
Yeah, the data on active managers is pretty rough, generally, and past performance isn't predictive.
Exactly. Now, index funds are great for getting market returns cheaply and efficiently.
But they won't give you above market returns, by definition.
Precisely. So, if your goal is to try and beat the market, Greenblatt argues that understanding and applying a sound strategy yourself, like the one he outlines, is a much better bet than relying on most traditional financial intermediaries.
It's about taking ownership and using a logical process.
That's the core message. Educate yourself, find a sound strategy with evidence behind it, and stick to it.
Okay, just quickly, any interesting behind-the-scenes details on how he actually ran the numbers for the book?
Yeah, he gives some specifics. The 17-year back test involved buying about 30 stocks each year, holding them for a year, then rerunning the screen and rebalancing.
So over 17 years, that's a lot of trades, a lot of different stocks.
Over 1,500 individual stock picks for each test he ran across different market cap sizes. That large sample size is important for the statistical significance, like we said.
And did he define those terms, return on capital and earnings yield, precisely?
He did, in the appendix. For return on capital, he used EBIT. That's earnings before interest and taxes divided by the sum of net working capital and net fixed assets.
Okay, a bit technical but specific.
And for earnings yield, he used EBIT again, but divided by enterprise value. Enterprise value is basically the market cap plus net debt, what it would cost to buy the whole company, debt included.
Why use those specific measures, EBIT and enterprise value?
His reasoning was to compare companies on a level playing field, regardless of how much debt they used or their specific tax situations. EBIT looks at operating profit before financing costs and taxes, and enterprise value looks at the total cost of the business. It aims for a cleaner comparison of operating profitability relative to the total capital invested.
Makes sense. Trying to compare apples to apples.
Exactly. It avoids distortions that can come from just looking at price earnings or return on equity sometimes.
You know, throughout this whole discussion, it's clear Greenblatt has a very engaging style in the book.
Oh, definitely. It's not dry at all.
He uses those analogies, the gum shops, Mr. Market, adds bits of humor, like mentioning the old Johnson Smith novelty catalog or dog racing.
Yeah. Keeps it light.
And he talks directly to the reader, asks questions, which we've tried to echo a bit here. It makes complex stuff feel much more approachable, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It matches his goal of making it understandable even for, well, his kids originally, and by extension, for any investor. It's very practical.
And just for everyone listening, we'll make sure to put clear definitions of those key terms: earnings yield, return on capital, enterprise value, and a summary of the formula's principles and historical data in the show notes.
Good idea. Makes it easy to refer back to.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this up. What's the absolute core takeaway from the little book that still beats the market?
I think it boils down to this. Systematically look for good companies defined by a high return on capital.
Meaning they're efficient profit generators.
Right. And buy them only when they're cheap, defined by a high earnings yield.
Meaning the price is low relative to their profits, quality plus value.
Exactly. The historical data suggests this simple combo, applied consistently, has produced excellent long-term results.
But, and it's a big but, you have to be prepared for periods when it doesn't work, when it underperforms.
That's crucial. Patience and conviction and the logic are non-negotiable if you want to stick with it long enough to potentially see those results.
So understanding these ideas, whether you follow the formula strictly or just use the principles to guide your own research, can really empower you to make more informed investment choices.
For sure. It gives you a logical framework, a way to cut through the noise and focus on what Greenblatt argues really matters.
Yeah.
Business quality and purchase price.
All right. So for our final provocative thought for listeners to chew on.
Okay, let's hear it.
Given the compelling historical results Greenblatt presents and the, frankly, pretty straightforward logic behind the magic formula, why do so few people seem to actually follow such a strategy consistently?
Good question.
What do you think are the biggest barriers? Is it purely psychological, the impatience, the fear during downturns, or are there practical hurdles, too, that stop people from adopting something that seems, on the surface at least, so simple and effective?
That is something worth pondering. Why is simple so hard to stick with in investing? Lots to think about there.
Definitely something to mull over. Until our next deep dive, keep thinking critically, everyone.
And keep learning.